good? All right. Okay, I was going to ask if anybody's sitting next to an empty chair, but it doesn't look like it. Welcome, everyone, to the New York Society Library and the 24th Annual New York City Book Awards Celebration. I'm Carolyn Waters, the head librarian. I also want to say hello to anybody who might be watching on their computer right now, because we are live streaming this on Facebook, which, if you think about it, is kind of an amazing thing to announce from a library that is 265 years old. So for those of you who may have only recently learned that we exist, we are, in fact, the oldest library in New York City, which I believe makes us uniquely qualified to recognize the best books of literary quality or historical importance that evoke the spirit or enhance appreciation of New York City. I want to congratulate all of our winners for your extraordinary achievement. These are some wonderful books. I would also like to express my deep appreciation and admiration for the New York City Book Award jury and their inestimable jury chair, Warren Wexler. You'll be hearing from all of those guys in a little bit. And also to Katie Freakus, who I think we can just call you sort of the jury wrangler. She's a staff member who works to help the jury. The jury spent countless hours reading, considering, debating hundreds of books in order to narrow it down to these six winners, which is quite an achievement. So thanks also to Jenny Lawrence for making possible the Hornblower Award for the best New York City-related book by a first-time author. And now I'd like to introduce Ellen Eisman. Ellen is involved in many book-related endeavors around the area, including serving on the advisory council of the Yale University Library and the Century Association Archives Foundation. But we are incredibly fortunate to call her a trustee of the New York Society Library for more than a decade now. And we are also extremely, extremely thankful for her longtime support of the New York City Book Award. So please welcome Ellen Eisman. And look at me raising it.
Thank you, Carolyn, and good evening. Each year I say a few words about the importance of these prizes, which shine a welcome light on vibrant, varied literary works that reflect New York's size, complexity, roughness sometimes, and beauty too. We hail the winner's achievements at a time when the traditional publishing business is increasingly contracting and authors more and more are losing ground. I'm pleased to be associated with the awards, both as a way to focus on writing excellence and on the extraordinary city that most of us call home. In today's disturbing, distorted political climate, books that are based on solid research and that demonstrate a measured point of view remind us of the standards we should uphold and applaud. Tonight we celebrate writers who have captured the spirit of New York, where this library has been headquartered, as Carolyn said, for an incredible 265 years. When George Washington briefly was president here, this institution became the main repository of books and information for the federal government. The library, acting as a continuing catalyst for cultural endeavors and as a purveyor of knowledge spanning three centuries, has earned a reputation for service to the community and is an oasis for intellectual pursuit in this busy metropolis. Thank you so much for coming tonight.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Warren Wexler. Our jury takes great pleasure in presenting this year's New York Book Awards. We're grateful to have read the books selected for commendation and very proud to recognize the authors who wrote them. Ours was a labor of love, but a labor nevertheless. We read portions or all of 139 books between our initial meeting in October and our concluding meeting in March. The jurors read every page of the books that we honor this evening. Guiding us all the way with good sense, attentive administration, and great patience and courtesy was the library's Katie Frickus, and we salute her. Head librarian Carolyn Waters, who took the time to be on hand for several of our deliberations, and her colleague Sarah Holliday, who planned this fine occasion, also have our gratitude. The heaviest lifting, of course, the task of reading carefully the many books submitted or acquired for our consideration and deciding which of them opened our eyes wider to this remarkable city's character and our history fell to the jury. Its members were Bianca Calabresi, Alex Gilvery, Carl Meyer, Janice Nomura, Stephen Raphael, and Geeta Tiwari. Will the jury please rise for a well-deserved round of applause? Two of our jurors concluded their terms this year. They are Janice Nomura, after 3 years of very worthy service, and Alex Gilvery, with us for a year of contributing significantly to our efforts, but taking a leave because of academic duties. We'll miss them at our table, but we will look forward to seeing them often around this splendid building. We thank Jenny Lawrence for the Hornblower Award, which means so much to authors getting up on their careers. Our endeavor, however, was possible so because of Ellen Eisman's generosity. Ellen's informed dedication both to this unique library and our city finds vivid expression in the prizes that we confer this evening. We thank her for helping us do our part in enriching readers' understanding of New York and perhaps heightening their sense of wonder at all this city has been, is, and yet might be. Thank you.
On the one hand, Elizabeth Acevedo's The Poet X needs little introduction. Winner of this year's National Book Award for Young People's Literature, among other major prizes, it is by all measure one of 2018's literary tours de force. On the other hand, the work's grounding in the Afro-Latina New Yorker experience and its power to move readers of all ages beyond its Harper Teen designation made it an important candidate in the eyes of this year's committee, which ultimately chose to acknowledge its distinct contribution to another understanding of the city. This captivating novel in verse is punctuated with ever-widening visions of Manhattan. It begins, "The summer is made for stoop sitting, and since it's the last week before school starts, Harlem is opening its eyes to September. I scope out this block I've always called home." The speaker is Xiomara, the 14-year-old daughter of immigrants from the Dominican Republic, who becomes, in the process of the work, the Poet X. Heir to another literary Harlem resident, Malcolm X, and perhaps with a nod to the X-Men, X takes to heart the Hispano-Germanic meaning of her name, warrior, but shifts her weapons from fists to words as she negotiates the restrictive realms of local parish, zone high school, and Catholic home, and begins to explore the street and the city on her own terms, to the dismay of her family. Her transformation culminates in a winning performance at the East Village New Yorican Poets Cafe, where Acevedo herself performed before becoming a national poetry slam champion and the author of a prize-winning collection of poetry. Polyphonic, biting, and ultimately triumphant, The Poet X also charts a broader historical shift for young women writers, from poetess to Latinx, exploring radical new notions of female minority identity against the backdrop of El Barrio's simultaneously cosmopolitan and parochial neighborhoods. For this glimpse into a world that is both potentially insular and infinitely liberating, we award one of this year's New York City Book Awards to Elizabeth Acevedo for The Poet X.
My name is Geetha Tiwari. I am a writer and an attorney. I am deeply honored to present this award to Yale Law School professor Stephen Carter and his family for one of tonight's six New York City Book Awards for Invisible, the forgotten story of the black woman lawyer who took down America's most powerful mobster. This award recognizes an African-American female attorney who committed her life's work to justice. Eunice Carter was born in Atlanta, Georgia in 1899 and raised in a universe of unfairness given her race and gender. Despite the hardships she faced in moving to New York in 1906, she made significant legal and political contributions to our world. She was one of Fordham Law School's first women of color graduates, and she set an extraordinarily high bar for future lawyers in her intellect, energy, and bravery. In writing about his grandmother, Professor Carter noted that as the first African-American female assistant district attorney in the state of New York, she was exiled to the seamy world of prostitution, carrying on a gendered tradition, consigned to what prosecutors of that era considered women's work. Eunice Carter successfully strategized the winning case against mobster Charles Lucky Luciano for prostitution, compulsion, and racketeering. The challenges Carter faced as one of the first female attorneys of color, discrimination on the basis of race and gender, continue to hinder progress today. To share my personal experience, I took several years off from the practice of law to study writing and bear children. In 2017, I graduated from the MFA program at Columbia University School of Arts and returned to the law. Interviewing for jobs, I faced questions about my children and childcare, illegal questions that I remember wondering whether interviewers would ask of the Caucasian female candidates. Certainly not men, I felt. Professor Robin Lenhart, the faculty director of Fordham Law School's Center for Race, Law, and Justice, had the privilege of recognizing Eunice Carter as an alumni of distinction this past fall. And in her remarks, she highlighted a recent New York Times article addressing the lack of women of color in partnership at large law firms in New York City. Quoting the lone African-American woman partner who described her feeling of isolation. Every day, going into a conference room where you are the only one, maybe the only woman, maybe the only black person, that can weigh on you. It is a struggle for women of color to break the stigma that we are tokens, to find sincere mentors, and to shatter the ceiling placed above us. Thankfully, progress has been made, and members of the New York City legal community have begun to assess ways to remove these barriers and create change. More can be done. Professor Carter said of his grandmother, "She hardly ever in her life complained about being mistreated. She was going to make the most of whatever opportunity she had. She could not have accomplished what she accomplished if she had been a person who was worried about what had been done to her by someone in the past. I can only imagine the immense burden that this one woman carried, and I am grateful to her and to Professor Carter for bringing her story to print and to inspire others in our work today.
I'm not Stephen Carter. I'm his daughter, Leah. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to join us tonight, and he's very sorry. But on behalf of my father, thank you so much for this tremendous honor. I actually did a lot of the research for Invisible, so it has been an amazing experience for me getting to know my great-grandmother and watching the book come to life. And it's very exciting for me to have the opportunity to accept this award in my father's stead. Every time that Invisible receives recognition or attention, it's really recognition for Eunice and all the exceptional work that she did throughout her life, which was long forgotten, but is once again getting the attention it deserves. I think that Eunice would be happy for her life story to be honored among all these other wonderful stories of New York City, the place where she spent nearly her entire life after her parents left Atlanta. I also think that her story is particularly salient right now. Looking around at the state of the world, it can be, especially as Gita just described and a lot of other things that are going on, it can be so tempting to give in to despair and for many of us to feel that the causes that we care about are hopeless. But Eunice and her family, who on so many occasions persevered in the face of overwhelming odds, remind us of the importance of carrying on with our chosen work. Thank you again.
It is my distinct pleasure to introduce Philip Ashworth Coppola, the begetter of One Track Mind, which I hold up here, which is also the product of the editing of Ezra Bookstein and Jeremy Workman. Mr. Coppola has a subject as ubiquitous as it is uncelebrated: the ornaments we see daily in the New York subway system. Mr. Coppola, who lives in Somerset, New Jersey, indeed possesses a one-track mind, which is also the title of a recent documentary celebrating his work by Jeremy Workman. Beginning in 1978, Mr. Coppola has become our subway archaeologist, a title which should become official, documenting the often smudged but omnipresent ornamentation of 110 subway stations with several hundred still to go. Our prize-winning book is gleaned from Mr. Coppola's self-published six-volume masterwork entitled Silver Connections, a folio encyclopedia which made its debut in 1984 and is available at selected libraries. He hopes to complete the project in the 2030s. He's now 70 years old. And always there is a story lurking beneath the design shaped by master craftsmen, most of them completed along with the founding subway lines by 1908. My favorite is the 137th Street name panel. In the two stations to the south, the number is wedded to Columbia University. For a decade, the indignant worthies of City College petitioned for equal prominence on the subway stop. In 1920, the Transit Construction Company agreed to the change, but only if the college funded the cost, which its alumni, faculty, and trustees responded so generously that the station was adorned with 12 beautiful mosaic panels resplendent in lavender and black, of which two are still visible today. We need to recall that the subways were built at the very crest of the Beaux-Arts style, in which God is in the details, to quote Mies van der Rohe, a later master designer. Examples, the late and destroyed Pennsylvania Station, New York Public Library, Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Frick Mansion, and the list goes on and on. Perhaps Mr. Coppola himself can tell us more about his service as New York's indefatigable subway archaeologist.
Good evening. My two friends are here to keep me, give me my support. But anyway, I do want to say thank you for being here. So 40 years ago, I started making a record of New York City's subway stations, particularly the architecture, their layouts, the iconic plaques, and the mosaic patterns. I describe them in text and illustrate the unique particularities in black and white drawings. Back in the 1970s, the way to deal with a grungy subway station was to build a wall of indiscriminate tile over their World War I era mosaic and ceramics. Or in some cases, even some of the original decor was ripped out and the station dressed anew in clean but uninspired brick or tile. So this compelled me to make a record of the heritage these civic works have contributed to the city's identity before any more got lost. Things had changed since those days, but still there are changes made in the system and structures are torn down sometimes and new ones put in their place. It happens. New York is a living organism, you might say. So this is the primary goal of my project. Secondary objective is to find the names of the people who made this work, who did all this work in the first place. Architects, engineers, modelers, manufacturers, ceramic potteries, artisans, mosaic craftspersons, because they have, for the majority, gone unacknowledged and been forgotten or not even known in the first place. Been many years since then. So it is my belief, and I believe that the people who have done this work should get the recognition they deserve. And that's my second goal. Now, I do want to say thank you to my supporters and my cheering section, some of whom are here tonight. Kathy Grace Rambush, whom I met back in the beginning years of my study, who was the lady with the architectural plans and has been a good friend since then. And Barbara Cohen, Judith Stonehill, and Yuki Ota of the New York Bound Books, who are my major booksellers, and they are my major champions all this time also. Andrew Alpern, AIA, and attorney, and author. That's five A's in a row. He has sent me bulk of source material when the first book came out, and we've had a good, interesting conversation since then. Wynne Armstrong, are you here? Hi, okay, great. Wynne Armstrong, who's with the Bloomingdale Historic Neighborhood Historic Group, invited me to do a tour of some of the stations in her neighborhood back in 2006. And she's been a friend all those years since then. And finally, the lady who gives me the word and the insights, the Reverend Liz Edmond, who is here. With her son Jasper, and she came over all the way over here just to find out what all the fuss is about. And now I'd like to turn it over to Jeremy and Ezra, my buds, who are the inspiration for this book in the first place, and did all the footwork and the heavy lifting.
Thank you, Phil. Thank you to this lovely New York Historical Library for this incredible honor. We're thrilled. I've been consistently inspired by Phil for over maybe 15 years now, maybe more. Yeah. I've been an advocate and interest in his incredible artwork and his one-man passion and project to preserve all the beautiful artwork that's in New York City. So this is a tremendous honor. We're really thrilled to be here. I've also really acutely and always believed that stories of New York City really represent the world, New York's history and grandeur and culture and diversity. So it's really an honor to be included as far as New York City books. Thank you again. And let me just introduce my co-editor, Ezra Buchstein, as well.
Thanks, Jeremy. Thank you. Thank you. You know, it occurred to me in the book we detail where the designs came from and what they represent, and through Phil's incredible research, it just occurred to me that for instance, the beaver at Astor Place, for you know, which was made in what 1902. And it's referencing 100 years before it for Mr. Astor, and this place was here, right? I mean, Vanderbilt, Astor, they probably all stepped through the doors here, and it's just such an honor to be recognized by this esteemed, storied institution. Thank you so much.
One last word, and I'll go away. And that is that we have to thank the Princeton Architectural Press. These guys had the idea that maybe my drawings make a neat little book if they put it all together and find someone to put it together for them. And the Princeton Architectural Press worked with them, and together we all worked together and made this proposal a reality. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Janice Nimura. I am thrilled and honored tonight to be presenting the New York City Book Award to Karina Yan Glazer for The Vanderbeekers and the Hidden Garden, which is the second installment of the wonderful series that began a year and a half ago with The Vanderbeekers of 141st Street. Now I have to make a confession. I am also thrilled and honored to call Karina my friend. We met when we were parents at the same school, and we have supported each other's writing for years, mostly in the form of baked goods. We have logged a lot of hours together on the fifth floor in the stacks in the green alcove, which is hard to snag, but wonderful when you get it. It has been my privilege to watch the Vanderbeekers emerge from her imagination and meet their public and their fans in the world. And I know what you're thinking. The committee is rigged. I solemnly swear that when the Vanderbeekers came up for discussion, I fessed up immediately, closed my mouth, and sat on my hands, and I listened. And what happened next was truly a measure of how extraordinary this book is. This is a book about five kids in Harlem and two parents and a diverse array of neighbors, and a dog and a cat and a rabbit. It is about good triumphing over evil, as most middle grade novels are. It is also about urban gardening, cookie baking, violin music, and gorilla knitting. It is aimed at readers in grades 2 through 5. And if you've been paying attention, if you no doubt noticed this evening that very few of the members of the committee fit that description. Only one of us even has children in that category. And yet each of them was charmed by this family and its adventures. Karina has managed to create a world that is for children and very much of this city and this moment, and yet it is a universal and timeless pleasure for readers of all ages. There aren't many authors who can get fourth graders reading under the covers. I know several. Make grown men cry at the ending. My husband, don't deny it. And inspire a Columbia literature professor to exclaim over the vivid symbolism of renewal and liberation in the climax. That really happened in the committee. Karina has brought New York City to schools full of her fans across the country, schools where the classrooms are decorated in her honor as Harlem neighborhoods. If you've read these two books, you'll know that, you know, Castleman's Bakery was in one classroom, and the Hidden Garden described in this installment in another. And if that weren't enough, Karina has also done all of the charming pen and ink illustrations in both books, evoking the scenes of the book so vividly that the movie rights have now been optioned by Amy Poehler. If you haven't yet met the Vanderbeekers, I envy you. I went down a steep rabbit hole just getting ready to do this because I had to read them again. It's the kind of book that you want to give to all the children in your life. So I urge you to go find a copy, not just of The Hidden Garden, but also of 141st Street, for all the children in your lives, but read them first. The third installment is coming out in September. I am so proud to introduce my friend, Karina Yan Glaser.
Wow. So Janice and I, we share a locker here, actually, at the New York Society Library, and we sometimes leave notes for each other, because that's the kind of people we are. And she's been so special to me. And if you haven't read her works, I'm going to plug them. Daughters of the Samurai is an award-winning book that she wrote a couple of years ago, and she has another one coming up about the Blackwell sisters. So that, definitely put on your radar. You're all book people, so you must know that publishing a book is not about just the author. There is a huge community behind that person, and I'm really happy to see a few of those people here with me today. My agent, Ginger Clark, is somewhere out there, and she has been incredibly wonderful. After she took me on as her client, I asked her what she liked about the story, The Vanderbeekers of 141st Street, and she said that she liked the rabbit in the book. And I asked her if there was anything else, and she said she really liked the rabbit. So I was really glad I added that into the story. Another person here today is Holly Frederick. She is first and foremost my friend and neighbor. But she is also that film agent that snagged those option rights with Amy Poehler that got all those exclamations. and I'm so grateful for her. From my publisher, my publicist, Tara Shanahan, is here. And a lot of you who work in books or publishing know that publicists come and go pretty frequently, and I have been so lucky that Tara has been with me since the very beginning, and if she ever leaves, I will probably have a fit and cry and beg my publisher to raise her salary by double to keep her here. And one last person, my husband, he's way at the back because he spent the whole day wrangling children, and he does this all the time, not just on days where I get to dress up and get an award. And I'm so grateful for him. The New York City Book Award is particularly meaningful to me because I actually didn't grow up here. I grew up across the country in Los Angeles, and I actually fell in love with New York City because of children's books. I loved books that you might have read when you were younger, from The Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler, All of a Kind Family, The Saturdays. All those books captured my imagination and made me really fall in love with the city even before I had seen it. And I knew when I was 7 that I was going to move here. And I did the first chance I got, and I came here for college, and I haven't left. And I love raising my kids here, and I feel really honored to write books set here. And thank you so much for this honor. I'm just really pleased and grateful.
healer, educator, naturalist, civic leader, and above all, citizen, the physician and botanical scientist David Hossack richly deserves the superb biography by Victoria Johnson that we are pleased to honor this evening. Her book, American Eden, David Hossack, Botany and Medicine in the Garden of the Early Republic, a portrait of the post-revolutionary era as well as the life of an extraordinary American, tells of New York surpassing Philadelphia as the nation's intellectual capital while securing its commercial supremacy. Hossack, a prime mover in the city's ascent, seemed to know everybody and championed a score of worthy causes. Attending to the fatally wounded Alexander Hamilton on the Hoboken Heights, he subsequently cared for the daughter of the former Treasury Secretary's antagonist, Aaron Burr. He also traded plant samples with Thomas Jefferson, counted Columbia classmate DeWitt Clinton as his closest friend, hosted Alexis de Tocqueville, knew the Marquis de Lafayette, and mentored Franklin Delano Roosevelt's grandfather during his medical school education. That list goes on and on and on. Hossack's passions, though, were advancing medical science through the application of botanical materials and principles and establishing institutions that would promote the city's singular success as a cosmopolitan center. He united Columbia University with the College of Physicians and Surgeons. He helped to launch the New York Historical Society and collaborated on the founding of the city's first Museum of Fine Arts and the New York Philosophical Society. But above all, he created, after a mighty struggle, the Elgin Gardens, a botanical and pharmaceutical cornucopia in its day, and Hossack's most cherished enterprise. Rockefeller Center sits on that land today. Victoria Johnson has made this force of nature come alive as a rounded human being. Her elegant writing gives us a great drama of large personalities by turns clashing and cooperating, as well as gracefully imparting a trove of information about the medical practices, culture, and institutional politics of their day. Exceptional in his achievements and heroic in surmounting grief after losing two wives and three children over 30 years, David Hossack triumphed over tragedy through civic endeavor, scientific and humanitarian engagement, and devotion to friends and family. In versatility, vision, and effectiveness, this New Yorker stands alongside Benjamin Franklin in the American story as a polymath and patriot. We thank Victoria Johnson for giving us the man in full with the New York Book Award.
Thank you. Like many people in this room, I come from a family of book lovers. My mother was a librarian. My grandmother was a librarian. Libraries, to us, are sacred spaces. This feeling is why, in the very first paragraph of the very first chapter of American Eden, I wrote this about David Hossack's childhood. Hossack learned the importance of supporting civic institutions from his father, who served as a volunteer fireman and was a book lover who borrowed piles of volumes from the local subscription library, the New York Society Library, founded in 1754 and still in existence today. Among the books he checked out were British novels, imperial histories, and adventure travelogues about Captain James Cook's travels around the globe. Now, when David Hossack grew up and was a young man, he spent a year studying botany and medicine in London. One of his mentors there was the great scientist and explorer, Sir Joseph Banks. How thrilling it must have been for Hossack to tell his father that he was regularly meeting with one of Captain James Cook's most famous travel companions. How thrilling, too, that this library is still a part of our city and our nation. Thanks to the work of so many people, past and present, and the financial support, David Husick knew all about how much financial support it takes to keep our civic institutions going. After all, he bankrupted himself founding a botanical garden. But thanks to all of these people, we have a record of the passion for books and ideas that has been sending New Yorkers to these collections for 265 years. And I was absolutely thrilled. I started this book in Michigan. I was able to look at the circulation records for David Husick's father from Michigan, from this library. It was an extraordinary experience. And I made sure to put it in that very first paragraph. It is a delightful honor to receive this award from such a venerable New York City institution and one with which David Husick had family ties. Thank you so very much.
It's my honor to introduce this year's Hornblower Award winner, Albert Samaha, for the book Never Ran, Never Will, Boyhood and Football in a Changing American Inner City. If you've read anything about the Brownsville neighborhood of Brooklyn, it's usually about the people who made it out. Alfred Kazin, Mike Tyson, or it's about the poverty and crime that's plagued the neighborhood for so many decades, its wealth disparity, the high incarceration rate of its people. It's a neighborhood that is easily crossed off, left to the far eastern side of Brooklyn, far from Manhattan, another world entirely separate from the affluent, thriving city. As writers, it is part of our job to tell stories of those on the periphery, to give voice and agency to those who have been invisible, overlooked, systematically oppressed. And this is why it's my esteemed pleasure to introduce this writer, Albert Samaha, who dedicated 4.5 years to reporting in and around the Brownsville neighborhood to tell the story of the Mo Better Jaguars football team, its coaches, and its players in his remarkable debut book, Never Ran, Never Will. From the descriptions of the practices, games, and hits taken, the thrilling scenes of against all odds determination, it's hard to remember that you're reading about boys who are 8, 9, and 10 years old. The sacrifices made by these kids and their families are remarkable. Reading about them, Samaha makes us really do care. Why, I asked while I was reading. It's because the stakes for the boys of the Mo Better Jaguars are so high, the prospect of success so slim. What will become of them if they fall away from the program? If they don't make it? If they succumb to injury? For these boys, the stakes are life and death. Reading this, we really pull for them, Geo, Ooms, Hart, and Isaiah, because Samaha tells their stories with the empathy of a novelist and a dedication to the truth. These boys are not just jocks. They are alive with intelligence and wit, innocence and spirit. What makes this book, what really makes this book is its characters, the people Samaha took the time to get to know in order to convey their lives. Albert Samaha lets us live with these players, walk them to school from their homes, worry for them through their parents' eyes. We track the coach, Chris Legree, and his staff, all of whom have dedicated their lives to their community and to keeping these young boys off the street. providing them with structure, community, and opportunity, placing them through football into some of the best high schools in the city and onward to college, and for the best of them, the NFL or football leagues abroad. The subtitle of Samaha's book, Never Ran, Never Will, is Boyhood and Football in a Changing American Inner City. I've pointed out how it's about boyhood and football, but this book is also remarkable as a portrait of Brownsville for its awareness of our preconceptions of neighborhoods we don't often enter and their realities. The changes that have been made in Brooklyn, the Brooklyn lifers like Coach Chris Legree, who helped instigate change, but who wonder how long they would get to enjoy the changes they helped create in a rapidly gentrifying city. This is where Samaha's great reporting skills really shine, in reporting the changes in the Brownsville landscape with respect to crime rates, gangs, housing, poverty, systematic oppression, incarcerated fathers. These boys play football in Betsy Head Park while all of this stirs around them. And Samaha is able to navigate each aspect of this story with incredible humanity, purpose, and hope. Albert Samaha is an investigative reporter at BuzzFeed News, a professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, and his work has appeared widely. It's my honor again to give him the Hornblower Award this year. Albert?
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, hello, everybody. This means so much. I spent 5 years on this book, as Alex mentioned. I was a different person then. In case, you know, I didn't remember that when you start writing a book about 10-year-olds and you look up and when you're filing the manuscript, they're 15 with girlfriends posting photos on Facebook of their sneakers. You really realize how fast time can change. And I think over the course of those 5 years, really my vision for the book and the ideas in the book evolved so much. You know, this is, I filed this proposal, or I kind of first thought of this idea, you know, before I Can't Breathe, Ferguson, Baltimore, Charleston, Cincinnati, Falcon Heights. And I wrote many of these chapters while covering those police shootings in those cities, you know, for my day job. Around the time I was filing the final manuscript, you know, the election had just left us all in confusion. And around the time I was getting ready to propose the book, the world had come to realize that the technologies that have made us be able to communicate faster and have the entire infinity of information at our fingertips also holds the capabilities to undermine our democracy and all the truth that comes with it. And that's the thing I really love about the process of going through books. The person I was and the ideas I had are not what's in this book. What's in this book is an accumulation of all the ideas that kind of built over those years. And, you know, as Alex mentioned, I work for BuzzFeed, so I'm sort of on the front lines of the garbage fire of the internet. You know, the heat is blowing on me every day. And it gets really easy to kind of feel discouraged about the direction our literary society, our truthful society, is going when you know, fake news is a big thing, and people seem more interested in sort of the small tidbits and the hot takes than in actual deep dives into truthful, deep, factual, important information. But I actually have a bit of optimism. I actually think that as our world contracts and as it becomes easier and easier to get short bits of information and to publish short bits of information, the kind of long, in-depth, rigorous stories, both reported and reported in, you know, the mind of a fiction writer, becomes all the more important and all the more valuable. And I really do feel like there is an increasing premium on that sort of work. Hopefully people can figure out the business model for making sure that happens. But I do think the thirst remains in the public. And I've been really excited to kind of talk to people who have read this book who, you know, don't read many books and kind of hear from people who have come to me and kind of, I guess I didn't realize how much people appreciated books until I wrote one and people started coming up to me and like telling me about it. And I think this is kind of the direction we're going in, is that there will be a track of kind of knowledge in society that will become increasingly centralized among whatever is the biggest story in the world and increasingly watered down over the course of aggregation and all this. But I think the in-depth stuff and the stuff that really matters will rise to the surface over time. So I thank everybody here for supporting that, everybody here for recognizing that, for my friends for supporting this, all my editors for supporting this. It just really means a lot. So thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Cheers.
Winners, a big hand. Congratulations to all of you. And thank you also to the jury. Amazing job. Now you can read some non-New York City related books for a while. A little while. I encourage you to stay, have some more food and wine, and buy some books from our friends at the Corner Bookstore, and I'm sure our authors would be happy to have them sign them. So, thank you all for coming.